We know that social media should be regulated, but we're so hooked on it that there's absolutely no political will to handle any of this. And so the moment that we have a, again, foreign adversary to point to, we can paint all of the ills on them, but then we're just going to go full surprise Pikachu in 6 months when we've banned TikTok and all of the problems still exist.
Welcome to the Dark Markets Podcast, your guide to the shadowy depths of finance, tech, and crypto. I'm reporter and historian David Z. Morris. Back in 2013, I became one of the first journalists to cover cryptocurrency in a mainstream publication. As a reporter for outlets like Fortune Magazine and CoinDesk, I've helped expose and bring down fraudsters like Nikola Motors CEO Trevor Milton, Luna creator Do Kwon, and FTX mastermind Sam Bankman-Fried. My guest today is Emmy and Pulitzer Prize-winning technology and culture journalist Dexter Thomas. Dexter is one of the only English-speaking journalists to ever interview the CEO of TikTok, Shou Chu. And he's here today to get me caught up on the possible U.S. ban of TikTok. Dexter is a former correspondent at Vice News Tonight and reporter for the LA Times, and we did a bit of commiserating about the dire state of journalism. But we first met more than a decade ago when we were both still academics researching Japanese hip-hop. Much like me, Dex is secretly Dr. Thomas. So we also got into why we both decided to leave academia and advice for others considering the jump. This episode also features the debut of Dark Markets Plus, bonus content available to premium Dark Markets subscribers. In today's bonus segment, Dexter and I dug into what it was like to work at Vice in its heyday and what went so wrong at the most promising digital media startup of its era. Please welcome Dexter Thomas, aka Dex Digi, to Dark Markets. I'm here with Dexter Thomas, a friend of mine for a long time. Dexter, for people who might not know you, tell me a little bit about what your background is, what you do now, what you've accomplished, which is pretty fucking impressive. and talk your book for a second.
Sure. Yeah. So where we first met was when I was working on a PhD. So my dissertation is on Japanese hip hop. Immediately after being in humanities and in academia, I also went to work. Probably my most high profile stuff was at Vice News. I was on a show called Vice News Tonight where I was a correspondent, all the way from 2016 until the show ended in 2023. So I've made short documentaries everywhere from Congo to Japan to various places in China, to all over the Midwest, about anything from drugs to presidential elections, to wrestling, to video games, to a weird true crime K-pop podcast that I made once. So yeah, done a lot of things, but mostly in the realm of what I would call, you know, journalism or documentaries about culture.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you left it out. And so I'm going to force you now to say, you have been recognized for this work in certain ways. Yes?
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. I'm the same guy. I don't want to talk about my shit either.
Right. No. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So the first, I guess, big one was the Pulitzer. And so...
I guess.
Well, it's a weird story. So I was born and raised in San Bernardino. Basically, I'm from San Bernardino, California, which is a city about an hour and a half east of Los Angeles. And if you're familiar with San Bernardino, it might be because you heard of a mass shooting. And so I'm from there. And so almost immediately after the shooting happened, I was working at the LA Times at the time. I'd actually just started. I went back and started reporting on it. And so some of my work went into the overall larger package that won a Pulitzer Prize at the Los Angeles Times.
Huge.
After that, I went to work again at Vice, and I've actually now, I think, 3 Emmys. I had 2, but I did, I mean, one, one for something that I was in directly, another one for the show in general, and then of course there's another Emmy for something that I did some Japanese translation on. It was somebody else's work, but I did the translation. But I'm in the milieu there. So depending on how you want to count it, two or three Emmys.
Yeah, I'm not at all envious. I was in the Pulitzer nominating package for CoinDesk's coverage of the FTX collapse. We didn't get that one, but I at least can like just touch the hem of your skirt and say at least in the running.
I mean, all this stuff honestly is kind of it's a little corny, but yeah.
And we're here today with Emmy and Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Dexter Thomas to talk about TikTok, to talk about the transition out of an academic career, to talk about the journalism industry, and we'll get into it. So welcome, Dexter.
Thank you.
Tell our listeners about what you're working on right now. And specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about TikTok today. So your coverage of technology in particular, I guess, is going to be most interesting to my audience. So,
sure.
What are you working on? What's up today now that Vice is gone the way of Vice?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, man. Thank you. Kind intro. So I say that I do culture. If somebody asks me what I do, which is, I realize it's a big topic. What does culture even mean? But culture for me is whatever keeps you on the couch, or whatever makes you want to get off the couch and do something, which again is everything. So it's just the spiral of kind of everything. Mm-hmm. But I try to say that to separate myself from, you know, nothing against people who say they cover entertainment or arts or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that just doesn't do it for me, because culture covers everything that I cover. Covers everything from presidential elections to drugs, social justice to video games to money to whatever. Mm-hmm. So I've covered all of that. And so, yeah, I've been really lucky in that sense that I've been able to kind of put my hands on a whole lot of different stuff, but also talk to a bunch of really smart people. But yeah, so you and I met when I was a graduate student. And I think maybe we met, you know what? Did we meet in 2014?
That seems impossible. But I might have been in Japan for like a summer that year. Would it have been in Japan?
It was definitely in Japan. And I think that might be when it is.
Well, I don't know. I think I met you before I was at USF, though. And I was at... I don't know. It's been a while. Let's just say that. We can leave it. And it's been a while. And we've both been through big transitions and transformations.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about culture. You cover culture. I know that but you go by online Dex Digi, right? And so
yes,
the digital aspect of that is definitely important to how you think about culture. And I know that, you know, when we met on the Japan thing, like we were both interested in the cultural part. I was thinking a lot more about, and maybe this is you too, but I was thinking about kind of that stage of globalization, right? Where like connections were happening around the world, and you had Japanese people adapting hip hop to their local situation, which I think is also part of your interest. And so it's interesting now that like TikTok is in the news, obviously, and in people's lives, where it's almost like the next level of that, where it's the infrastructure is global too. And you have all these questions about how you reckon with that flow of things happening all the time. Mm-hmm. I have not followed the story super closely. You've talked to a lot of players. So can you give us kind of the rundown on the TikTok thing first? And then we're going to kind of go back and talk about academia, journalism, and some of the other bigger issues that form the kind of background of our relationship. But what's going on with TikTok? We had the house thing happen. Give us the like summary.
Oof, man. I mean, the maybe most crucial question is going to be, when are you going to put this out? Because by the time this drops, the situation could very well be different. But I mean, the run of it right now, and I think this is going to be relevant no matter whether or not the app is actually banned or not. The one of it right now is that people might remember back in 2020, then President Donald Trump attempted to ban TikTok. He tried to do this through an executive order. He tries to push this thing through. It doesn't work. It's shot down to court, essentially, right, because
it's got to be a freedom of speech issue or something, right?
So that's a really good point. It never quite got to that stage. I think that challenge is going to become more serious this time. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening right now is what's happening in 2024 is you've got a bill which is bipartisan, is going through. And essentially what they're trying to do, instead of just trying to push through an executive order, they're making it a law. And they're saying, mm-hmm. hey, it's illegal for a foreign adversary, which China is officially a foreign adversary of the United States. Not my language, it's mm-hmm. their language. There's a list of countries that include Russia, North Korea, China's on there too, of course. And an app that is controlled by a foreign adversary, you cannot distribute it. So you're not going to get sued or thrown in jail for having TikTok on your phone. It just means that the Google Play Store and Apple, the App Store, aren't allowed to either allow you to download it or allow you to have updates. And they can charge, I think that they can get fined $5,000 per user.
Man.
And that's about $750 billion, given TikTok's last numbers that they released publicly. So Google nor Apple do not want to pay that bill. So what they're doing essentially is they're saying it's legal for to distribute any app that is controlled by a foreign adversary. And then, of course, TikTok is the one that's actually on their minds. So
this is the general language of the bill is
this is the general language of the bill is foreign adversary.
But it's targeting TikTok.
It's absolutely targeting TikTok. So there's other apps, obviously, you know, WeChat being mm-hmm. one, which anybody in mainland China, that's what they use. So mm-hmm. that's going to have a whole other effect if it's banned as well. But TikTok's the one that they're targeting. And it's starting to look like this actually truly has some momentum.
Mm-hmm. Because we did have that bill pass the House.
Right. And Biden has said if they can get it to him, he'll sign it.
Yeah, wow. That's and you know, I think that I've seen, again, I'm not following it super closely, but I have seen people who I generally consider fairly sane, like Matt Stoller, saying that he doesn't think it's a bad idea. I mean, obviously there are reasons to feel uncomfortable about it. But you know, what are the risks, if any, of this kind of legislation? I mean, we're in the digital era. Congress has not managed to really regulate any American digital anything. And here they are coming after a Chinese opponent. I mean, is this just, I mean, my thought sometimes is that this kind of thing is just misdirection from deeper issues.
Yeah. So that's where things get really sticky. So look, TikTok, and of course, I'm sure your listeners are going to be aware that the argument for banning TikTok, well, at least the one in terms of what's written in the bill, is that it's a security issue, is because essentially China controls all companies that are in China, and China has there's no expectation of privacy in China, that the government can read any message between mm-hmm. any users that they want. And so those standards, those norms are going to be applied now to Americans, meaning that China, the government, has full access to American citizens or American people in the same way that they have access to their own people. For national security interests of the United States, that is a bad thing. There has never been any documented evidence of the Chinese government accessing American messages or data. None. Not even alleged. That's why it got thrown out the first time, mm-hmm. because it was a hypothetical. That's what the judge said, that this is purely a hypothetical. This isn't enough.
Yeah. And then related to that, I mean, it's also not even clear, and you know, China is China, but it's not particularly clear that the, you know, Chinese Communist Party has actual like control over TikTok, right? There is a company called ByteDance. And mm-hmm. I mean, what is your sense of that? Obviously, China is completely different, and there's some kind of influence over most enterprises, but what is the right degree of control? What is the reality there?
Yeah. So this is where things start to get sticky, right? So I'm just going to say the big elephant in the room here is xenophobia.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Completely. And xenophobia is, as we like to say, it is a bipartisan feature. Democrats do it. Republicans can do it. Maybe one does it more than the other sometimes, but it is something that is not unique to either party. So that being said, yes, ByteDance, it's better to think of it that the TikTok that we have here is theoretically basically walled off in terms of data. Theoretically, this is what TikTok has promised everyone. This is what the CEO has promised everyone, is that I actually have what he said here. Yeah. So in the hearing 2 years ago, the CEO said, and I'm quoting here, "American data is stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel." That is what he promised everyone.
Mm-hmm. And wait, maybe I missed it. Where are the servers?
Right. So Oracle is overseeing the data. So, and there's also a kind of this independent company that is able to audit all of the data to make sure that it's not supposed to be influenced by either TikTok or its parent company, ByteDance. The problem is that since then, there have been leaks that suggest, and this is within the past 2 to 3 months, that suggest that actually ByteDance, again, the Chinese parent company, has been requesting data from the American TikTok. And that they won't stop doing it, and that internally there is pressure to comply. So whether this is sloppy management internally, which I think some of it is that, or there's something actually nefarious going on from a U.S. policy standpoint, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that at least means there's who knows if it's grounded in reality, but there's at least some kind of perception that would seem to justify this kind of paranoia, I guess. And I mean, we have seen, and it's not like this is TikTok's fault, but we have seen these crazy things with US military personnel sharing intelligence on forums and stuff like that. So there is some framework, or at least some reference point for leaks happening through what we would think of as nobody is going to be stupid enough to do that. But we had, I'm forgetting his name, Teixeira, I think, who was just posting stuff to some forum, and now he's going to prison. So there are leaks happening.
Oh, yeah. People have been posting stuff on Discord. It's, this is people uploading military intelligence to a damn, to a Discord version of basically 4chan.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what to say there.
Not the same thing. I guess maybe what I'm working towards is what is the actual security compromise that people are worried about, right? I mean, you have theoretically location data for individuals. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the Trump version was kind of a hypothetical, but what even is the hypothetical, I guess, is my question. What is the risk that they're concerned about?
I mean, so this is where I start to get a little bit out of my depth. But I think the concern seems to be that if somebody has TikTok on their phone, TikTok will be able to access everything else on their phone, all other messages, or which is, I've seen that suggested. I don't think that's quite as easy as some politicians may think it is.
Yeah.
But also location data is certainly an issue. And here's the thing. TikTok has been caught tracking location of journalists, but so has Uber, and so has Facebook.
True.
So most of the things that we are accusing, most of the things that we have any hard evidence that we can accuse TikTok of, American-based companies have done the exact same thing. There's a really good article on 404 Media that breaks a lot of this down. If you look at basically any social media app, and we're talking, Discord is used for, I'm just going to say, child trafficking, and keep it very top level. We know what Twitter has become. Pinterest has been used for some also very nefarious things. Instagram, the people internally know what it does to you know, young people, body image, all these sorts of things. Also, if you want to buy drugs or a whole bunch of really bad, quote unquote, bad things, Instagram's a great place to start. So TikTok is not unique in this sense. And one of the things, when I say xenophobia is kind of the elephant in the room, the letter of the law speaks specifically about security. But if you listen to the people actually talk about it, policymakers talk about it, you know, head of the FCC talk about it, they're saying, oh, well, you know, there's the version of TikTok that's in China is this wholesome content. It's science. It's good for kids. And they give us this drivel and this brain rot. Fam, if you think there's not fake news on the Douyin, the version that's in China, I have a great wall to sell you, because I guarantee you, and I've seen it, it's there's also very terrible stuff happening on there. There's really bad stuff happening basically on every social media platform. My take on this is that, leaving aside the security issues, because security issues also exist, again, with American companies. I understand there's a Chinese layer to it or a foreign adversary layer to it, fine. But I don't actually think that's what is upsetting most people. I think what is actually happening here is that we know that social media should be regulated. We know that there should be guardrails on this, but we're so hooked on it. We're so personally addicted to it. And this is everybody, you know, Gen Z, Gen X, boomers, everybody. And they spend so much money lobbying that there's absolutely no political will to handle any of this. And so the moment that we have a, again, foreign adversary to point to, we can paint all of the ills on them. But then we're just going to go full surprise Pikachu in 6 months when we've ban TikTok and all the problems still exist.
Yeah. I would add to that, you know, it's the lobbying for sure, but I think there's all, like, the lobbying is obviously there for a reason, right? Which is to maintain the stock price of these companies. And I think that there's a lot of that that's internalized too, which is, you know, we can't regulate Facebook or Twitter because Facebook is like part of the Fortune 500 and like the Dow Jones Industrial Average at this point. And so I think that that's like the other, that would be my addition to that list, is I think there's a certain like economic chauvinism that is very central to this too.
And here's a really other interest. Speaking of lobbying, I'll just throw this extra bit in there. TikTok has been lobbying. So maybe we should jump back here real quick. So I'm, and this is not a flex, I'm one of very few people who have ever interviewed the TikTok's CEO. And this was in December of last year. This was for Wired.
Yeah, I remember.
And I'm not saying it as a flex. It was sort of a fluke. Mm-hmm. And I think it was part of their sort of new strategy, because I think maybe more interesting than what he said was where he said it, because it took place at a music festival that TikTok was throwing.
Oh, yeah.
Because TikTok is trying to throw a music festival. So, and you know, I think it went fine. It was in Mesa, Arizona, man. Like, this is not your standard place to go to for music festivals. But essentially, in talking to him and even talking to their PR person told me straight up, this lobbying stuff is not as effective as just telling the users to tell everybody else how much they love the app. And so they have spent some money in DC, they've spent a few million over the past few years. Like they've increased, but we're talking single digits. Meta, 20 million over 1 year.
Yeah.
Easy. Pocket change for them. Exactly. And so TikTok has realized the politicians of DC are not listening to them. It's more effective to just try to communicate directly with their users. And you know, you tell me if that's working, but they're certainly of the opinion that the move for them is not to try to duke it out in DC. It's to make themselves completely indispensable, to weave themselves into the fabric of life, which they've actually done.
Yeah.
Looking forward, I think there is a chance that it gets banned. There is a chance that it gets removed from the app stores, and just what that'll mean for everyone, you know.
Right. And this is the next thing that I definitely wanted to talk about.
Yeah, what that'll mean is that more than likely, right, is that your app will not be remotely deleted. Again, you're not going to get in trouble for having TikTok on your phone. What's going to happen is you just won't get updates anymore. And so you'll be able to use the service for a while, But then, you know, just like if you don't update your Twitter or you don't update your Instagram app, eventually it's going to stop working properly. Certain mm-hmm. functions are going to stop functioning, and then you're just not going to be able to connect anymore. And that could take a while, but that's what's going to happen. But the thing is that TikTok has absolutely shifted. You know, the meta has shifted. They've shifted how mm-hmm. we, I'm just going to use the phrase, consume culture. We like vertical, easy to watch, you know, short attention span, vertical videos on our phone. That's what we prefer now as mm-hmm. a society. That doesn't mean they're going to be around to reap all of the benefits. It's entirely possible that they get kicked out of the States anyway, and we just move to another app collectively. You know, we move to Reels on Instagram. Mm-hmm. We move to YouTube Shorts. This is what happened in India. Mm-hmm. India, if you were on TikTok in the early days, you knew that India were power users. You were mm-hmm. seeing stuff from India all the time because they were making more videos than anybody. But they banned it in 2020. It was over some border stuff. Like, they had actual security stuff. Right. I mean, they had like military stuff with China. And so not what we have, at least not right now. And so they banned it. It's been about 4 years and they still make videos. They didn't stop making videos. They just use other apps. They're on Reels now.
Yeah.
You know, so that could totally happen.
That's interesting. I had no idea about the India ban. And that's a very clear example, right? Where like you literally cannot have your like soldiers on the border giving their location information away, but it's not the same, you know, it's not the same situation. But that said, you know, the transition could be whatever, but I'm also curious, just, you know, you mentioned they're like recruiting users to be vocal about this and express right. themselves. I mean, let's talk about the impact TikTok has had. It came to the US in what, 2018, something like that?
Right about there, yeah.
And really has taken over. I mean, how big is TikTok in the US, let's say, relative to like Facebook or Instagram?
Oh, geez. I mean, I couldn't tell you things like, I mean, what you would want to talk about would be things like screen time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know, what a Coca-Cola executive would call, you know, share of stomach. You'd want to talk about like share of eyes or brain right, or something yeah. like that. So I don't know that specifically. I do know that TikTok has said that, you know, there's something, you know, somewhere a little south of 200 million users just in the States. And, you know, 130, 150, I think something like that was a number that they've given, which makes entire sense. And so it is, I think, maybe more important than how many people are using it is just, again, the effect that it's had. You can't be anywhere without seeing a TikTok style vertical video.
Yeah. And they just get pulled off, and you see them on Twitter all the time, even,
yeah,
you know, an old man like me, they show up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's completely everywhere. Again, the cultural impact that it's had has been, it's unmatched. It's completely yeah. unmatched.
Well, in terms of like, let's moving on from TikTok specifically in terms of the political stuff. I mean, as somebody who pays attention to this stuff, like, can you offer, you know, some kind of read of what that cultural change is, right? I mean, I think that there's like the very shorthand is like everybody's attention span is getting wrecked by whether it's Twitter mm-hmm. or short video or something like that. But I mean, beyond that, like very well, first of all, I don't know if that's even true, but like, what is your read on that transition? I mean, maybe we're just talking about social media in general Ooh. Now. What have you seen? And I mean, I'm curious because you talk to creators, right? Like, you talk to people who are actually like users of these things and are engaged with yeah. it, and maybe they can see the more positive side than some of us who are just like, frankly, in the journalism industry, getting taken out one by one by all this stuff.
I don't think I've talked to anybody who is big on TikTok who isn't depressed.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, anybody that I've talked to has said, and I think there's, now I haven't talked to everybody, obviously, so I have a small sample size here. But anybody, I should not depressed, anxious, because of the difference, you know, anxiety being worried about what's coming, right? The anxiety that I would guess would be a near universal, because you never know what the algorithm is going to do.
And these are people who are kind of like relying on this for income, right?
For some, and some more than others. Yeah. You know, some I know a few people who make, you know, decent amount, like decent side hustle, from TikTok. But it's, you know, it's nerve wracking, because the thing is, up until not too long ago, the main way to make money on TikTok was by making videos that are shorter than 90 seconds. Then all of a sudden, and then they end the creator program, which was, that's what it was. They end that and they tell everybody, hey, now we are only paying for videos that are longer than 90 seconds. We want 2 minutes and up. All of a sudden they want long content. I really don't like this word, but I'm going to use it. They want long content, because that's what they think of everything as. They think of everything as content. Yeah. You know, the CEO speaks of music as content. Everything is content.
I get where you're coming from, but I actually kind of like the word content, because it actually gets at just how indistinguishable everything has become. I mean, it's almost like a critical term in itself, you know?
I'll take that. I actually, in that sense, I'll agree with it. Like, I would never I don't love calling other, I would never tell somebody, for example, I love your content.
What other people make is content. What I do is art.
Exactly. Exactly. I think it's a completely unhinged way of talking about things, but I know that's how, what happens now. But
the changes can happen without any warning at all.
The changes can happen completely without warning. One of the things that I've really noticed, and something I noticed really early that I haven't really heard anybody talk about, is TikTok is the place where I saw people become aware of the algorithm in a deeply intense way that I don't think happened anywhere else. So if you talk to somebody who's primarily a Facebook user, and you ask them about the stuff they see, they'll say, oh, you know, they only put the stuff there that they want you to see. What is they? Who's, what stuff? What are you talking about, right? And it's this kind of conspiratorial mass media, mainstream media, you know, it's that kind of thing. And I think that's always existed in some way. There's this very dim understanding, I think, and this isn't even an age thing, it's just it's a dim understanding of how the things that you see, it's not completely just a pipeline, a stream of information. It's being tampered somehow.
Yeah.
TikTok is different. TikTok, because of the way the algorithm works, you become aware of the way that the algorithm works. I mean, if you get on TikTok, are you on TikTok?
Honestly, no. I've, like I said, seen it secondhand, but that's it.
Anybody, you know, I think maybe the government might not love me saying this, but if you don't use TikTok, get on TikTok and just spend, over the next week, spend 45 minutes. What'll happen when you first get on TikTok is it'll show you like a cute cat or something.
Yeah.
And then it'll show you, you know, nature, or it'll show you somebody doing a funny dance. You might see that funny dance and you might say, I don't like this. So essentially what TikTok does is it learns really quickly what you like, really, really quickly. And then it gets more and more niche until you are seeing in jokes from your hometown that only somebody who went to your high school in a certain 5-year span will understand, because they're joking about the gas station on the corner. It gets that, and it happens really quickly. That'll happen within a week. And so with TikTok, what will happen is you'll see comments where people will say something like, commenting so that I get more of this. Which is to say that people are trying to influence the algorithm.
Like they know that the algorithm,
they understand, there's an awareness. And it's this really interesting thing. Like, you want to talk about artificial intelligence. It's like you realize that, oh, this is a machine. And I can program the machine. It's like a really low level, or not, I shouldn't say low level. It's like a high level version of programming. You realize that, oh, if I watch this video, or so let's say that if you let a video loop once or loop twice, TikTok figures, oh, you like this. Let me show you more. If you comment, oh, you really like this. Oh, you liked it. You shared it. You must love this. I'm going to show you more of these things. And so before you know it, you're watching, and I wish this was a joke, you're watching like cartels singing anime songs. This is something that is on my page. Turns out I find this interesting somehow. And so now, is anybody else getting that? No, you're probably not getting that. You know, my next door neighbor is probably not getting that. You know, coworkers probably aren't getting that, but it dials in. And so what ends up happening is you're trying to program the program, but the program is programming you. Mm-hmm. You dig what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's this really weird dance with the algorithm that started with TikTok, because TikTok's algorithm it's really simple, but it's really, the sophistication is very simple, or the simplicity is very sophisticated,
yeah.
I should say,
yeah.
or both. And other companies have started to emulate that. So now you're seeing that bleed out into the rest of the internet, where people are becoming more and more aware of the algorithm, but also trying to influence the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you're at the precise time when you start speaking the language of the machine, it's also programming you.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe you know more about the sort of timeline here, but I mean, that has been pretty significant, right? Like both Instagram and Facebook and even Twitter now have at least like prioritized more this like for you feed or whatever it's called in each individual case, where like you're not getting the stuff from your friends anymore. You're getting pure algorithmic. I mean, was that a response to TikTok, or was this kind of all business models kind of evolving in the same direction at the same time?
I think they're all evolving in the same direction at the same time. I think TikTok is the one that really did it properly. You know, I mean, TikTok is basically doing what everyone else was trying to do and just doing it better.
Yeah.
You know, like Meta has been promising that we're going to have a place where we can hang out and message each other and do work and, you know, the metaverse, right? That's why they changed their name to Meta. They're not actually doing it. TikTok is doing it.
Yeah.
Like YouTube, the problem with YouTube is it's a great place to watch things, to consume content.
Yeah.
You cannot create on YouTube, it's not possible. TikTok has an editor built in.
Yeah.
You never have to leave the app. And if you never have to, why would you?
And you know what? I'll say this. I think this is what makes YouTube the only good social media site. I think that like barriers to entry are good. You know, I think that like,
hey,
that's my take anyway. I think that, you know what? Too much democracy, it's a mistake.
That's always where it ends up, isn't it?
But okay, let's like kind of on the TikTok thing, let's get to like the meta narrative here. Sure. Have you got a read on this bill goes to the Senate? I mean, do we have any sense of what's going to happen there? I mean, we've heard Biden say he'll sign it. Democrats control the Senate. Does that mean this is going to pass?
I mean, it I don't think it really matters who's in power there. I think it could pass. It seems to have support. I think the First Amendment challenge is going to be, that's something to take seriously. It's something to take seriously. I know that we tend to kind of misunderstand what First Amendment is. Like I think the lay understanding of First Amendment, and by the way, I'm not a lawyer, but the lay understanding of First Amendment basically seems to be, I can say whatever I want in this comment section, which that's not really what it is. But First Amendment really doesn't like limiting access to expression. And, you know, there have been precedents of people who have been convicted, or one case that I'm thinking of in particular, of a person who was convicted for crimes against a minor. I think that was the official language that was used. And he was told, and there was a law on the books, I think this is in North Carolina, that you cannot be on social media where children are also. And about 10 years later, 8 years later, he posts on Facebook, and the cops figure out that this guy posted on Facebook. He's like posting about being happy that a parking ticket got dismissed, gets in trouble. The Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, said that law was not constitutional. You cannot, because how woven in the internet and social media is with our lives now.
Yeah.
Telling somebody that they're not allowed to read, definitely not read Facebook, but post on Facebook, you can't do that. You can't prevent somebody from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the courts are willing to bend that far, again, toward something which I think a lot of people would agree would be totally okay with, again, which is to say, you know, somebody who's been convicted of a sexual crime against a minor, not letting them use Facebook, cool. I don't care about that. A lot of people would say that. A lot of people think that's very reasonable. Courts didn't find that reasonable at all. So does that set a precedent for this? No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that the courts take First Amendment really, really seriously. And so there's going to be a fight at the end of this thing. That's my guess.
And in terms of, you know, let's say hypothetically, whether it's a temporary thing, whether there's some kind of injunction or let's say at the end of the process, we do lose TikTok. Like, what is the impact on, I mean, let's, obviously we're talking about Americans here. So like, what's the impact on whether it's like, you know, teens who are consuming this stuff or the creators or, you know, as you said, culture, right? Like, what's the cultural impact if TikTok goes away?
You know, it's hard to say. I think on individual levels, there's going to be a bit of a shakeup, right? There's going to be people who have kind of put all their eggs in one basket, to use the phrase, which is to say they've built up a following on TikTok and not anywhere else. And, you know, there was this really interesting moment in the beginning of TikTok, or, you know, as TikTok became more popular, where it used to be that a TikToker, when that phrase was just starting to get used, they would have a link to, or they would tell people, you can find me here. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. TikTok was not their home. TikTok eventually became people's homes. You know, there are people who their stuff gets reposted elsewhere, but really TikTok is truly where they just live. Whereas a lot of journalists, for example, where they live is Twitter. That's why so many journalists will not leave Twitter. Won't do it. Even if they disagree with, you know, the leadership, disagree with, they don't like how it looks, they think that, you know, the app sucks now or whatever, they think the moderation sucks, all these things, they won't leave it because that is their home. The home will get ripped away from them.
Right.
If this thing gets banned, it will get ripped away from them. That's just what it is. And so, you know, you'll potentially see some people who are really big failing to convert to another platform. There'll be a bit of a shakeup. But in terms of the methods that we communicate in, I think those aren't really going to change because, again, dude, Zuckerberg is waiting for this to happen because we've got Reels. Reels does, it's a copy.
Yeah.
Just like Stories was a copy of Snapchat. There's imitator products out there that are basically the same thing.
Do you think on that question, and by the way, actually just very quickly, because my audience is a lot of crypto people, I should identify that this is what we call platform risk, right? This is like people who have built something using somebody else's thing that somebody else controls, and then it disappears out from under you for whatever reason. And so this is one of the reasons, like, my faction of the tech world is very about like immutable things that can't be screwed with this way. But aside from that, so you have Reels. Maybe this is like a very minor detail question, but hypothetically, let's say you're in Mark Zuckerberg's shoes. Like, does Reels then spin out to be its own app? Or is like, how do you reorient that? Because like Instagram right now, like Reels are there. And like people younger than me use that maybe even as their primary part of Instagram. But like, it's not front and center. It's kind of similar to the way Threads is like kind of buried in some little niche thing and in its own app, but it has kind of failed, frankly, to take off. So, you know, like, what might we, I don't know, let's say you're like a Facebook stockholder, like what's the play there if you're trying to maximize?
You know, it's a great question. I think the interesting thing though is my guess would be that they wouldn't have to do much because if you look at YouTube, for example, there are people who never watch regular YouTube videos. They only watch shorts, and there are people who only make shorts for whatever reason. The YouTube, so if you're not familiar, YouTube has, again, a copycat function of TikTok, which is just vertical videos, and you can swipe through them, you can like them. If you've never used TikTok and you think it's going to be hard to figure out, and you've been on TikTok, you've been on YouTube, you've been on Instagram Reels, the interface is almost precisely the same because it's copied, right? So there are people who only make YouTube shorts, and that is all they do. And they've gotten extremely famous off of it, make a lot of money off of it, and they've never made a horizontal video in their life. So there are entire communities or ways of using the app within the app. So I would imagine that Instagram wouldn't really have to spin a new app off. I suppose they could. And I think that's probably on the table for them. I feel like I've read something like they're thinking of spinning something off, but they don't have to, you know? And of course, the other thing is that even if they do, they're keeping everything integrated in-house. So again, you're using Messenger, which connects to Facebook also for those of us who, I left Facebook a long time ago, but if somebody wants to message me via Facebook, it'll come into my Instagram inbox. Things like this, it won't be hard for them to adapt. Mm-hmm. They're already kind of ready for it, I think.
Moving on to kind of the implications, right? We're talking about TikTok, we're talking about social media, and, you know, I mean, I'll give the oversimplified version, but you were at Vice for a long time, and Vice has now essentially disappeared, or it's become a content studio. I lost my job in media recently for kind of unrelated reasons, but in general, the media situation is real bad. And I think that the simplistic version of that is often that, like, social media has and or search, I guess, taken away a lot of those revenues and a lot of that attention. And so I just want to transition kind of to talking a little bit about media, and then maybe get into a little bit about Vice specifically if you want to. But, like, what is your, I mean, high level, as somebody who's paying a lot of attention to social media specifically, like, do you see, I don't know how to ask this, I guess, but maybe the really hammer on the head way to ask it is, like, is social media making people dumber, making people's attention spans worse, making the kinds of stuff that we care about more trivial? Like, what is the impact that you're seeing from, like, at a systemic level, the takeover of all this stuff from, you know, we used to read magazines. We used to be a society.
Right. You know, I think it is social media, and I will say TikTok especially, has gotten pretty good at limiting our attention span. You know what a meta is?
Like, as in a game meta?
Yeah. Okay. So for those, should we explain it for the listeners?
Sure. Game meta? Yeah. You take a shot. You're the gaming expert.
I don't know if I'm an expert, but I'll break it down real simply. So, for those of you who know what a video game is, you know, feel free to, you know, send me an Instagram message and tell, not a tweet because I won't see it, but Instagram message, tell me I got it wrong, but watch this. So TikTok, or excuse me, not TikTok, tic-tac-toe, pardon me. Right. Tic-tac-toe seems like a fair game, evenly distributed. It's actually not. The meta is the game within the game. So the meta of tic-tac-toe is to go first, go in the middle. Mm-hmm. Bring this out to video games. So video games, say Street Fighter, right? Mm-hmm. Street Fighter, you know, you've got the characters, they're throwing fireballs at each other. You would think, okay, it doesn't really matter which character I pick. It's all based on who I think looks cool or whatever. No, it turns out that when the first Street Fighter came out, there were certain characters that were actually better than others. And the developers didn't even realize it because they didn't spend that much time on the game. You got people who spend all this time on the game and they realize after grinding, spending hours and hours and hours on the game, actually, if I pick this character and I stand here and I throw fireballs in this way, I will almost always win. So they have to update the game, make new games so that they fix these imbalances that they didn't realize what they were. So this is the meta.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And the change is kind of my understanding of the meta is always about, like, change. If you change one part of something, then, like, the significance of everything else shifts around it. That's the fact. Yeah. That's, like, why people follow the meta. You have to, like, keep up. You have to, like, watch updates, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. So in, you know, in video games, they're constantly patching the game. They're constantly updating the game nowadays because you can just download the games. They're constantly making the game so that it's more balanced, or so that, you know, they think maybe it'll be more fun, or maybe it'll make the company more money. Okay. Taking this to journalism, the meta is constantly shifting, and it's shifting really quickly. So the meta used to be, if as long as you've got a decent headline, people will probably click your article. But then if everybody remembers, I mean, I think I put this on Upworthy, and, well, AJ Plus was doing some of this too, but Upworthy was really doing it. Remember when we started using the phrase clickbait?
Yeah.
And this was back when it was things like, you know, this guy's dog came back after a year and you'll never guess what he did next. And you think, well, damn, I want to know what he did next.
Yeah.
that worked for a long time. And then we got so used to it, it stopped working. Mm-hmm. And so we required higher and higher, you know, attacks on the dopamine center. And mm-hmm. so I think what's happening now is the meta now is you can't spend 5 seconds setting something up, or you can, in a documentary, say, for example, you can't have 5 seconds of quiet mm-hmm. that sets the scene. You have to immediately hit the viewer in the face with, this is what I'm going to tell you. Mm-hmm. You know, for mm-hmm. example, if you've seen TikToks, it's a perfect example, because TikTok is where the meta has advanced the quickest. And here's where I'll sort of prove that I think attention span has truly, truly gotten bad. People will be telling a story or be trying to talk about something, right? And this is in a situation where somebody is not physically taking you somewhere. They're just talking to the camera. They mm-hmm. won't just talk to the camera. Like mm-hmm. They're telling you a story about something happened, but they're not actually there anymore. Mm-hmm. So they're just talking to the camera. So what do? They'll start doing their makeup. Or they'll start brushing their hair. They'll start cooking.
As in, like, they have to be doing something else while they're telling the story for the additional interest?
To keep your attention.
Yeah.
Because they know if you just talk to the camera, and they know this. They know that the meta is such that if I just talk to the camera, somebody will flip away. I have about a second, maybe 3 seconds to keep their attention. Mm-hmm. And so they'll start doing their makeup. Now, this is what we're doing now. What we'll be doing in a year, I don't know. And so this keeps happening. And so, you know, I think it has affected the quality of the kinds of articles and the kinds of mm-hmm. things that we're able to make, because we do realize, I think, as a writer, I mean, if you're a writer, you realize that damn near nobody's going to read your stuff. Let's just be real with it. But even as a documentary filmmaker, you know, I realized that the stuff that we put on TV, I mean, I've been telling one of the editors that I've been working with, like, he would make stuff where it's about 30 seconds and it's on TV and it sets the scene and you get to see, you know, this big wide open space in Alabama and you get a sense for what it feels like to be in Alabama and you know, this particular part of Alabama. And then you see somebody walking, okay, what's this person going to do? And then you see him crying. Why is he crying? And it sets the emotion and it sets the stakes. You can't do that. You have to go right in. Yeah. You have to say, this year, 5 people were killed as a result of whatever.
Yeah.
Right off top.
Yeah.
And it's just changed things.
Yeah. And, you know, I know I set you up to give that answer, but I also, as you're talking, am being reminded that there are counter trends, which are like, not, mm-hmm. I'm not going to necessarily say this like optimistic, but it's at least like hopeful, which is, you know, I mentioned YouTube. And one of the interesting things that I see on YouTube now is people making like 7-hour documentaries.
Yeah.
And
that's the counter to it.
Like,
right.
I don't know if that's like, I don't know what to make of that exactly, but I don't hate it. You know, I mean, I'm like, I, for one thing, personally, I'll sit and watch a 7-hour documentary about Metal Gear Solid.
I think we've seen the same one.
but more generally, I also, and you know, so let's also talk about your project that you've got going on now. You've got your own thing going. I don't know if it's if you're doing Substack or like a documentary production thing, but you know, mm-hmm. I do think that, you know, I've had definitely modest, but notable success getting people to pay for access to my like mm-hmm. weekly 3,000 word essays about Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, right? Like I'm working on one project. I have a small but meaningful and very valued audience who are actually like kicking in financially. And so there are these like niche things that are, you know, because of different sets of tools, whether it's Substack or whatever, like you can reach those people. It's smaller. Mm-hmm. You got to work harder. But like, yeah, talk about what you're doing now and whether that fits into, you know, some kind of counter trend.
Yeah. So I think that is the counter trend. I think that's a great thing to put, because, you know, I think the things that are hurting media are things like attention span in that sense. I think, you know, advertising certainly has actually had a more nuanced and difficult to understand, but I would argue bigger role to play. Mm-hmm. But then what I'm talking about here is strictly the feeling in the attention economy, because that's what this is, mm-hmm. that you have to catch somebody before they go do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, that on Instagram, you're going to see war footage, cats, somebody dancing,
yeah,
war footage, and then like a meme about the $1.50 hot dog at Costco.
Yeah. That hot dog comes back all the time.
Exactly. And you have to stop them somehow, right? You have to stop them in their tracks and get them to pay attention to this, mm-hmm, and not the cat, please. So, but once you've got their attention, I think people are actually okay, as they always have been, mm-hmm, to lock in to and give you a bunch of time. Yeah. And so, you know, what I was doing, one of the things that I was doing at Vice, and there was a bunch of stuff, was we had a Twitch channel. And the concept went through a few iterations, but what I landed on and what I thought was the most important thing and the most valuable thing was, I didn't want to imitate news, mm-hmm, which is to say, I didn't want to imitate TV news. I didn't want to go, you know, spend 5 minutes on one piece, 5 minutes on another piece. I mean, we just spent how long, I don't, mm-hmm, know how long on TikTok. I did an interview for NBC on TikTok recently, and that whole thing, including the sound bites that they used for me and some other ones, it was 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. There is no way in hell that somebody listened to or watched that thing on TV and came away fully understanding, right, what's going on. Right. It is absolutely impossible. Mm-hmm. So what Twitch or any streaming service will allow you to do is what we would do and what I do now independently is I'll pick one topic, maybe two, and we'll spend a long time talking about, precisely like we're doing here. The, right, difference between a live stream and a podcast, of course, is, well, it's live, and because it's live, somebody can tune in at that time and A, you know, feel like they're part of a community, which is kind of a cool thing, and B, ask questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Weirdly, I think the first one is more important to people. And that's something I've been surprised at. So my endeavors are not making any money. I'll say that straight up. Not directly. I won't say too much about this because I have some plans for it. But as it is right now,
right, it's a long haul.
It is, and it's not something that you start out. Listen, for anybody saying, "Hey, I want to start out talking about news or talking about whatever on, mm-hmm, Twitch," you are not going to make money immediately. Yeah. It is very unlikely. I have made enough to buy myself lunch. Yeah. A nice lunch,
yeah,
but only lunch, yeah, right? But that's to say that the thing that I've noticed is I think people like being able to ask questions, but people like being able to be in an environment, I don't want to say a safe space, but kind of a safe space where, mm-hmm, you know what, I'm not going to have to deal with trolls. The person who moderates this is going to, you know, set some ground rules, but also we all kind of know each other. You know, I have people who come in and I might have 22, 25 simultaneous viewers at a time. It's not nothing, but it's not a ton, right? It's not as many as a lot of people have. There's people with hundreds.
And just right in the middle of this, by the way, how do people find you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I am Dex Digi on everything.
Okay. So while we're Digi talking about your channel, people can go seek it out. But you have, you know, a like, you know, modest but committed audience, I would assume.
Yeah, and they recognize each other, and there's inside jokes that they have with each other. They remember things. I bring on guests much like you do. I bring on guests, and so, you know, they'll ask me, yo, can you bring this person back on? Mm-hmm. This is happening in the news. Can you bring this person back on? And that is something, man, I will spend 2 hours talking about fill in the blank. I spent probably 2 hours talking with somebody about the civil war in Sudan. Mm-hmm. I had somebody call in from Jerusalem and we talked for a long time. But then I also had a dude come on and talk about black hair and video games. And I treat all of these really seriously, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. You can go long on anything. And I think that's really valuable.
I think about it in terms of something that I worry about, but I guess maybe it's also, there is an upside to it, which is, you know, you have your TikToks, you have tweets on Twitter, you have, you know, Instagram reels, and those are kind of like the top of a funnel. And a lot of people, I think, only stay at the top of that funnel. And that's what I worry about is like, if you're only seeing the reels, if you're only seeing the TikToks, but at the same time, you know, you think about like, I mean, I'm old enough, you're probably old enough to remember when like the 30-minute evening news was all there was, you know? And like, if that's where you just stop and you only get that one source, then that's a problem too. And it always was. And, you know, you're in media studies more or less. And when I first started in grad school in the early 2000s, it was still a conversation about corporate control, right? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is an important thing to keep in mind from the like positive side, is that as much as everything seems broken and messed up, there is this democratization. And when I'm not joking, I actually kind of appreciate it, because you have people who are going deeper and are able to lead audiences into that deeper space. And, you know, there are people who are, you know, we're still figuring it out for ourselves, but there are people who are successful at that. But I also, like, I think it's just this, like, there's this bifurcation, right, where you have people who are only going to watch the TikToks, and then you have people who are going to go deeper and learn more. And I don't know whether that's, like, good or bad, or if that's just same as it ever was. You're only going to get a certain number of people who are really engaged with things. So, I mean, I don't know. Is it like, are we in doomsday, or is this, like, a turning point where people are getting back to, like, maybe the people who are willing to go deep are doing it?
Well, I mean, beyond the people willing to go deep are doing it, I think there's the ability to, you know, and there's the ability to be more informed on something that wasn't possible. I mean, I know more about the 6502 chip that was in the Nintendo Entertainment System than I legally should know. This is not information that I need to know. I know so much about the video game industry from its inception up until about 2005 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Like, put me on Jeopardy.
Yeah.
Put me on. I will win. I will double a small country's GDP. Easy. But this is possible because there are people making this stuff. I mean, there's a guy who is going through, this guy, Jeremy Parrish. There's this dude who has a Patreon, and he is going through he's doing a retrospective on every single Game Boy game.
Yeah.
From the first one that came out.
That level of depth.
And it's possible. And if that's possible for such a silly thing, and I'll call it silly, he'd probably call it silly. You can do the same thing for very, you know, we might both agree, geopolitics, you know, local politics, whatever, that's entirely possible. I also think about things like, say, you know, like, do you watch Joe Rogan's podcast?
No, but I mean, I see, you know, it pops up.
Precisely. I don't. That's not my kind of dude. I will never watch his podcast. I've seen a couple clips. That's cool. I can tell this isn't really for me.
Mm-hmm.
It gets shown to me a couple times. I was never going to watch that. And so it's not a bad thing that I'm getting the surface version of his podcast, because I'm not going to be into that. There's other people I'd rather watch. So, you know, I think it's okay that some people will only see the clips. You might post a video clip of this and somebody looks at it and says, yeah, neither of these dudes are really for me. Mm. And that's fine.
I happen to already know I'm not everybody's cup of tea. So.
You know what I mean? And then of course, I also think about platform risk, like you just said, right? You know, whether it is TikTok or Twitter, or Substack. Substack also operates on an algorithm in a long sense. So, you know, damn near nothing but having somebody's either phone number or email is reliable. Unfortunately. So I think, are we going back to something kind of, but I also think we're going on into some pretty unexplored territory right now.
We're talking about people's ability to go into depth about, you know, obscure topics. And of course, classically, the place where you go into depth about obscure topics is academia.
That's a transition.
Both. Hey, you know what? I'm getting better at this.
This is good.
So we like both it. Have totally useless PhDs, as far as I can tell. and so I wanted to talk to you, I mean, kind of from a, you know, I think there's a lot of people in academia, and it's only accelerated over the last 10 years, who, I mean, I don't want to be too harsh, but who have realized that they've maybe been sold a little bit of a bill of goods. We've both made, I think, very fruitful transitions where we got the like best that we could out of that system, and then decided that we needed to go do other things. So kind of first of all, just talk me through that process for you, that decision? And then I want to get into kind of what the strategy was of, you know, making a different career for yourself. So like, what got you out of academia, I guess, is the first question.
What got me out of academia was being honest with myself. I'll be dead serious. Mm-hmm. Academia is a cult. Grad school in particular is a pyramid scheme. If you're looking for permission to drop out of your program, my friend, this is it. You may drop out of your program. You have my permission. Academia is a cold game. And I think I knew as I was going in. So I'll explain my trajectory. So my trajectory was, as a college student, I had become interested in Japanese hip hop specifically. And, I learned a bit of Japanese, had been once as part of a kind of cultural exchange program, had a good time, wanted to go back. Okay, the logical way to do that is via scholarship. Mm-hmm. I was somebody who was always very good at school, figured, okay, this is a no-brainer. I applied a bunch of times, was always rejected. Finally, I think the fourth attempt, I finally got a Japanese government scholarship, essentially.
Nice. Did you do JET? And no, not JET.
No, I never did JET.
What was the one? I'm forgetting, but do you remember the program?
Yeah. Mobusho.
Okay.
The Mobusho scholarship. We call it the Mobusho scholarship. That's just the name of the governmental department.
Because I got some government thing, but it was like a postdoc, and I don't even remember what it was called now. So different things.
Yeah. Later, I did a Fulbright later. So I did not postdoc. But one was already in grad school. Yeah. I did one later. But this one was, I had graduated undergrad, but I hadn't actually entered grad school. Mm. So the program that I was on, essentially, and it's all paid for by the Japanese government. So shout out to the Japanese taxpayers. Thank you so much. But you go out and they essentially, assuming you can also get yourself into a Japanese, get yourself as a research student attached to a school or find kind of a professor sponsor over there, which I did, they will essentially pay for your room and board and any tuition fees for 2 years. Yeah, basically, I managed to get myself over to Japan. And the way that the scholarship works is you have 2 years to get yourself into a Japanese university as a graduate student in Japan. And if you can do that, they will continue to pay all the way through when you graduate as either a master's degree or a PhD. So at this point, I hadn't entered a graduate student program at all. Mm-hmm. I was in this weird in-between stage, a research student. And, you know, I was doing research on my own, but as I started telling people, hey, yeah, I think I want to go to grad school, people were a little confused, like, wait, really? This I don't know if this is really your flavor, man, but cool. I mean, go for it. Anyway, so I ended up going to graduate school because I didn't find a school in Japan that I thought a program that was good for me. I went to school at Cornell, and listen, I liked it, enjoyed the program, but I think I started realizing that the culture of academia was just something wasn't for me. And one of the, really the way that I got out was boredom. And I'll explain what I mean. I, in 2010, was writing an article about nationalism in Japanese hip hop. I know you've covered similar things. We've quoted each other.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's when we met. I think you reached out to me at the time you were working on that.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, so we've quoted each other. Yeah. So if you search both of our names, you will find him, you know, David quoting me quoting David. It's like we were kind of the only people writing about this, weirdly. And so, particularly in English.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I wrote an article about this in 2010, and it was done in 2011. Mm-hmm. That article did not come out until 2016.
Yeah. And like, that's the life, man.
Yeah. And it went through revisions and it went through peer review. And let me tell you, the peer review did not make it better. I think it actually made it worse. If you read the article it was something in Routledge. It was a special issue of Routledge. Mm-hmm. And you read the one that, as it appears in my dissertation, the one in my dissertation is better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not because I revised it. But it was because I reverted it.
Yeah.
Because I was made to put a bunch of stuff in there that I didn't actually think was very good. Mm-hmm. And I was able to unlearn a bunch of really bad writing habits. And so that's all to say that I'm writing about rap music, man. 5 years in rap, how many rappers are still even around after 5 years? That's 2.5 generations.
Yeah.
And so I got so bored as I was waiting for edits that I got on this site, which is a shell of its former self, medium.com. Still exists, obviously, but it's not what it was. Mm. I was using it when a bunch of tech bros were using it, essentially. And I just started writing about culture stuff.
And you got like immediate gratification, I'm sure, like responses and readers and...
I got responses, but I also got what peer review was supposed to give you, which is critical feedback. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there was some just straight up trolls, specifically because, look, I'm a black dude writing about black dude stuff on the internet. You already know what's mm-hmm. going to happen. But I also got some thoughtful responses. Hey, here's some things you didn't think about.
Yeah.
Have you thought about this perspective from a woman's perspective? Guess what? No, I hadn't. Now I have. Thank you. And so I was able to improve my writing by actually being out in public.
Yes.
And I think I really, really, really started to realize at that point, wait a second, this thing that was this process that has been lauded within the academy, it actually doesn't work because it's slow. I think it can work. Don't get me wrong. I think it can work. But I think a side effect of it is that people have actually been scared to publish or write anything.
This was a huge
that's why you get these really long you get these really long overwrought sentences where I don't mean to say this and I don't mean to say that, and by no means do I mean to suggest this. It's just, bro, what do you want to say? Say the thing, be wrong in public, get better, move on. That's what this is all supposed to be about, and I think we've sort of lost our way. I just realized I didn't want to be a part of that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like maybe the way that that it really works is if you're just like a historian and you don't have that kind of time pressure where you're writing about something that's mm-hmm. happening right now. I think that's one part of it. I mean, just really briefly for me, it was like kind of similar but slightly different, which is, you know, I was always, even before I went into grad school, I was thinking of myself as like a writer. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who cares about craft, academia can be pretty deadly. And I really like the moment when I realized that was I actually got I got offered a book contract for my dissertation about Japanese hip hop, and mm-hmm. I was like corresponding with them, and I was like, oh, this is really exciting, this is cool. I have some X, Y, and Z ideas. I literally, it was like, oh, I have this like idea about what could be on the cover. And the reply I got back was like, no, we have one team that does all of those and you have no input. And like, it's not even like a creative process at all. And at that point I was just like, not only do I not want to do this book, which I ultimately didn't do, I just like fucking ghosted them, abandoned the contract. But I'm like, that was like one of my like 4 or 5 points where I got out of academia that drove me out. But so, briefly, like what, once you made that decision, like what kind of moves, I mean, for people who are in that situation, what were the moves that you made? Obviously you were writing publicly and that had kind of a, like a psychic effect for you, but literally practically, how did you go do something else?
Okay. So I'm going to say, if anybody's listening to this looking for inspiration or advice, I'm going to say something that is going to sound discouraging, but hopefully I can make it up for you. So I never applied for anything ever.
Mm-hmm.
Everything came to me. And so this is going to sound like, oh, you're just privileged. You're just getting everything coming to you. You're a total unicorn. Maybe. Sure. So what happened is I started writing on Medium, just blogging, essentially. I'm blogging. And then, you know, Al Jazeera English hits me up and says, hey, your writing is interesting. Would you like to write for us? Guardian hits me up. Hey, we saw what you wrote over in Al Jazeera English. Would you like to write for us? Complex does the same thing. I think I very rarely pitched, very rarely, because I wasn't good at it because I didn't know how. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand how to pitch. I was used to, again, like a good student, somebody tells you to do something,
getting an assignment,
do it.
Yeah.
Thank God for me, somebody gave me an assignment the first time. Same thing with the LA Times. Somebody at LA Times hit me up and said, hey, I see what you're doing. Are you interested? Mm-hmm. Vice, same thing. Hey, I saw what you're doing. Are you interested?
Yeah.
That being said, I do think the odds that I was able to make the kind of transition that I was able to make are frankly higher than most people's odds of getting a tenure track job in this market.
Absolutely. 100%.
Straight up. Like, you think the media game is cold? try academia.
Yeah.
And so but you know, again, that sounds like, oh, well, man, you just got lucky. The thing is, the really nice thing about being an academic and then venturing out is that you realize that you do have some skills. Frankly, basically you have the skills to just hyper focus on something for a really long time. Yeah. We just talked about this. Listen, this is no disrespect to you. Who cares about crypto, bro?
Who cares about crypto more than me and like five other people? It's like not that many.
Yeah. No, look at this. Look at the markets right now. Shouldn't everybody be paying attention to it like they were a couple of years ago? But they're not.
Yeah.
Clearly, this is a weirdo hobby. And yet, you have people who are not only listening to this, but reading your newsletter and actually paying you. Yeah. That is incredible. Yeah. But you're able to do that because you had that ability to hyper-focus. Mm-hmm. So here's the thing, is that if you were in academia, you have the ability to hyper-focus. What you don't have the ability to do is to make your own luck. Mm-hmm. If you step outside, you now have the ability to do both, because you can hyper-focus, you can do the work, but you can make your own luck. I was able to make my own luck by just writing at a kind of breakneck pace and publishing everything and trying things and being wrong a lot, but learning from it.
And to put that into slightly different language, I think one of the things that people do need to know, and that not everybody is cut out for when they're trying to make that transition, is like, you have to be a hustler. Like, you have to when you say make your own luck, like, that's like, you have to be reaching out, you have to be networking, you have to be following up on stuff. I mean, you are the business at a certain point. So I think that's maybe the most fundamental like advice for people coming out of academia, is that you're not inside the system anymore. You have to like work the system to a certain extent in a different way. And I, you know, just to like follow up quickly on what you said about your opportunities and situations and transitions. I mean, I actually had the exact same thing happen, or like even a slightly like more privileged version of it, which is I met somebody at an academic conference in like 2007, who then 5 years later, when I decided I was out, I was leaving academia, she was following me on Twitter. And by then she had also left academia and was an editor at Fortune. And so like she reached out and she was like, you want to do this? I'm here. I can hook you up, basically. But it's also because we knew each other, we knew each other's work. I mean, it's just like, it's like any career kind of works like that too, is you're putting yourself out there and people know what you're doing, then you will get that pickup. I mean, I'm just to say, like, I'm kind of in the same boat of like, I don't want to say happenstance, but like something came along and it just like doors did open up. I mean, academia can open doors that are not in academia, right? Like, that's the other thing that's worth, you know, and you finished even though you had this, you know, other set of priorities. It's worth it because the doctorate does mean something to people, you know. I mean, I think it's sometimes hard for them to process it. They're sometimes just like, you're an alien, but you're an impressive alien, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, I never talk about it. So I defended in April, I think May of 2020. Mm-hmm. So it was all remote, you know, straight up middle of lockdown. I finished. It was more for me.
Yeah.
I wanted to. I was done, and I just, hey, let me get this thing and be done with it.
Yeah, but, which good. Like, you know, I finished while I was still kind of in the grind set, so to speak. And I think that like that's easier. It's a lot harder to like already be off doing something else and then be able to like refocus and like bring it back in. Which, so kudos.
Yeah, I had a full time job. It was tough. Thank you. Yeah, it was tough. But I'll also say, you know, I was hustling as a grad student. Mm. So when, you know, when I wrote that article in 2010 and there was some editors who said they wanted it and then they actually ghosted me. Mm. It was really strange. Mm. I got so frustrated that I said, okay, well, if I can't get anybody to read this thing, if I can't publish it, you know, this is 2011. I was blogging in 2014. Mm-hmm. So this is 2010, 2011. I said, okay, well, I'm going to give a presentation. And so usually as a grad student, you'll know this, usually, you know, people will start doing presentations, you know, going to conferences, maybe your second, maybe your third year, you know, I don't know how it was for you, for a lot of people. My second year, I went to six. I spent my own money going everywhere I could. I presented at Comic-Con. I got myself into Comic-Con to present. I drove myself to Ohio.
So you already had that kind of more expansive mindset.
Well, because I was realizing that nobody was going to do it for me. But I also realized that the ceiling was going to be really low to what I could do in academia. And that's not to say that I needed accolades or money or anything. It's just to say that I could hustle really, really, really hard. And what was going to happen was a few more people, and by a few, I mean a few more dozen people might have a chance to look at my stuff, because I was having to drive somewhere to a room full of people and tell them, here is what my research is. And I would tell, I would talk to people and say, I'm thinking of putting this online or something. They say, oh, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
That's bad. It's people will steal your work. They'll steal my work. Like, who cares?
That was another one of my big moments of academia was like, there was actually a controversy at some communications conference because they wanted to stream it and everybody flipped out. And this is like 2017. So it's not like it was an alien concept, you know? No, it was before that. But still, it's like that kind of like, I was very turned off by that, like, defensiveness, right? Like, you have peer review, so you have a conversation of some kind happening, but you're not like this, like, active resistance to being in the public eye seemed to like contradict the entire point of the project, right? You're there to serve the public's need. You're often like at a public university, for that matter, being funded with public money. I went to grad school on the Iowa taxpayers' dollar, which also eternally grateful, but like, you owe something back for that. And that always sat wrong with me too. But you're talking about like hustling and like doing it in academia and like, I mean, are you saying you felt like the returns were not as big as they should have been on that like effort?
You know, I mean, I don't think I thought of it like that back then. I think I was just happy to have anybody looking at my stuff. Yeah, and so I was very actually satisfied. Every single place that I went, you know, people responded well to my work, to my presentations. And I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I'd love it if somebody has some beef with it. I can try to get better. But it's great that people are paying attention to it and seem to care about it at least a little bit. That's great. Yeah, you know, I mean, with the being afraid to publish stuff, I think, look, I have a YouTube playlist from formerly when I was at Vice of all my stuff. I was nervous every single time one of those things went on air. I have lost count of how many articles that I've written. I am nervous every single time I hit publish. But I think, unfortunately, another thing that has happened, I don't even want to, like, leaving alone quote unquote cancel culture, which I don't even want to get into necessarily. But I think, unfortunately, and I'm specifically talking about the humanities, we get so used to tearing people down and not, I think people deserve chances to grow and to get better. And I think that's what the humanities, the project, is all about. And I think because we don't allow that for others, because we get so used to just creating straw men out of everything, and I've done this in the past and I've moved on from it, I hope, that we're afraid that people will do that to ourselves.
You internalize that cop, so to speak.
You internalize it. Yeah, exactly. And you know, we have to get over that. You have to be willing to be more generous with other people's thought, and you have to be more generous with yourself to realize that, listen, I'm going to try something. I'm putting it out there. Please read it. And if you don't like it, if you think something's wrong, it's okay to tell me, and it's going to hurt. It hurts every time. But as long as we're both moving in the same direction of finding something out we didn't know, that's got to be cool for you, man.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be, I mean, you have to have that confidence for sure. But yeah, you have to like be trained to have that confidence and do it in a situation where, you know, maybe somebody has your back or you have a mentor or something like that. I mean, that's, if anything, the thing that I worry about most with the journalism industry.
But beyond the confidence, man, I think the responsibility. I think, again, you know, you went on Iowa taxpayers' dollars. You know, I went on, I had a full ride on at Cornell. Like, we went because somebody else, and even if it wasn't the money, I had teachers and professors who put hours into me that they did not have to. I owe the rest of the world the responsibility of trying to get, learn as much as I can and share as much of that as I can as possible. And so,
and bring that seriousness that you've been trained in to things that matter to people, I think is another part of it too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And if I'm not sharing that, and if I'm not willing to be wrong in public and get better and take that sting a little bit, genuinely, and I mean this with all the diplomacy and kindness in my heart that I can manage, if you won't do that, if you cannot do that as an academic, as a person in the humanities, genuinely, you should get out of this business and do something else. Mm-hmm. If you're not willing to let to feel that sting a little bit when you're wrong and somebody tells you you're wrong and then use that to get better, you should not be in this business, because academia is a business. There are other businesses which are much more appropriate for you. Yeah. If you're not willing to take that responsibility, do something else. It's okay. Nobody be mad at you.
Yeah. That's really important. And I think maybe the most like ethically centered reason to think about academia in different ways, because it's not just, are you willing to take the accountability, but like you have to be willing to take the accountability from the public, not just the people who are like in your guild already, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that that's a good place to stop for now. Tell us on the outro, again, where people can find you, what you're working on, what you're doing. So just, where can people find you?
Yeah, I mean, on any social media platform, I'm DexDigi, that's DexDigi. So that's twitch.tv/DexDigi. But the center for everything that I put out would be whatupdex.com. That's got all my articles, all my most recent documentaries, podcasts. I just dropped an album.
Nice. Still making music.
Yeah, it's a long story.
Well, you got to keep doing that stuff too. I just made a short film recently, so I got to stay engaged.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. No, definitely, man. So I'm just really trying to stay creative. Doing a bunch of consulting recently.
Very nice.
And freelancing. Yeah, no, it's great. But yeah, so whatupdex.com would be where.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Dexter Thomas, for coming on. Somebody who I have known for so long, it makes me feel old, and still at it. We are still out here. And thanks for coming and talking about TikTok, etc. I hope you stay well, and we'll keep in touch, and we'll have you back sometime.
Yeah, man. Let's get it.
The Dark Markets podcast is edited and with production assistance by Eleanor Paul. Music is by Altus Nomina. Writing, hosting, and production, flaws and all, are by me, David Z. Morris. Dark Markets is a listener-supported production. Subscribe at darkmarkets.xyz to receive the Dark Markets newsletter. And consider a premium subscription to get bonus podcast content and full access to early drafts of my book in progress on Sam Bankman-Fried. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.